Hello and welcome back to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part series which focuses on the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico. This week we'll look at the changes of land in New Mexico and what it means for culture in the state. Today, land management is a dilemma. Do we value development more than open land, which continues to give us fruits? Or do we find a balance to work with the land in a way that gives us what we need and cares for it at the same time? Land and water are tied. It's difficult to address land issues without also talking about water. Lately, it seems that there are two types of transferred lands. Lands being transferred from agriculture to development, and land whose water has been transferred from agriculture to development. This is Janet Jarrett, dairy farmer from Los Lunas.
There are two types. What you have is a lot of rangeland that tends to be out of the valley floors. That land is difficult to make a living on. You know, it's typically been ranch land and cattle grazing. And the cattle market's a pretty tough market to be in. It's up and down, depend on the rain. So you have people generally from out of state come in and buy large tracts of this land and have this wonderful development planned. And they almost always include golf courses and all these things up on the Mesa land or Vega land that's up the Llano outside the valley floor. Well, that land doesn't have any water rights with it. It's never been irrigated. It doesn't have a water right. So in order to irrigate things like the golf courses or to provide water for those people, they have to transfer water out of the valley floor. Well, when you dry up a piece of agricultural land, it's gone from being productive cropland with a fairly stable amount of water consumption to, generally speaking, a weed patch. Either it's a weed patch or somebody builds houses on it and sinks more wells and double dips. Well, if it comes back up in a weed patch, then you've got a lot of riparian that comes in there, and it typically consumes more than the cultivated crop does. Alfalfa consumes a lot less water than a weed patch full of weeds and willows and salt cedar and all those things. They will consume more water than riparian does. So what does your actual wet water supply look like? Well, now you've taken twice as much water as used to be used on that land is now gone from the system, either through depletions on that land because it wasn't really vacant, also the development on the mesa that they've gone forward with. It's a very speculative market. I mean, in Albuquerque, the pretty famous one is the old Atrisco land grant lands, 56,000 acres on the West Mesa, no water rights, out-of-state speculators, trying to get somebody to come in and provide a water supply. And they, you know, preferably an entity that has the power of condemnation so they can actually get at some water if people don't want to sell. There's a stigma attached to selling your water rights, too. You know, if people find out their neighbors sold their water rights, they're not well thought of anymore, particularly in areas like where I live, where people have been on the land for generations. They sell their water rights. They're rather viewed as traitors. So a lot of times that water rights transfer is kind of a hidden process where you don't see it because of what we discussed earlier with the state engineer doesn't do enforcement. If you're really going to dry up farmland, you're going to have to treat that land so it's not growing anything. And how many people that live in a rural area want their neighbor's land, whether it's 5 acres or 30 acres or 100 acres, to be brown? You know, we very much value our green belt. You know, they call it that ribbon of green down the river. What happens when that's brown, but there's a bazillion houses on the mesas? Is that really what people want? Is that what they want to live? It's not where I want to live. And I really want to leave my kids some opportunities in the future to make some different decisions, because whatever we know now, it's not the same as what we'll know in the future. By doing these kinds of transfers and not thinking about the connection between water and land use, we're leaving the future no options.
This is Dino Cervantes from La Mesa, New Mexico, below Las Cruces. Mr. Cervantes is a large-scale chili farmer growing for Tabasco-style sauce nationally.
The Las Cruces, Doña Ana County area is seen quite a bit of growth over the last 5 years specifically, and even before that, but it's become pretty intense the last 4 or 5 years. And agriculture is under a lot of pressure our farmers are under a lot of pressure. prices keep getting squeezed. We have a lot of competition. The amount of the markets that are open to us are limited. So a lot of farmers, in a lot of cases, find it to be better to go ahead and sell out to developers. I guess from an agricultural standpoint, and considering that we're going to be in agriculture moving forward, or my family is, I don't think that we necessarily oppose the development, just as long as the development is done, you know, on a consistent basis, and it's done with some thought process for future generations, how things are going to work. You know, do we have the facilities and the infrastructure available where a new development is going to be? If the infrastructure is available, and are we developing in the areas that are, I guess, least problematic long-term for some of the industry that we have in the valley? What we've seen in the last couple of years is land values increase in the cities or developed communities already. Developers have pushed farther out. And so instead of filling in space in and around cities or small towns in southern New Mexico, they go farther away to get cheaper land, if you will. And that creates problems, because then you have roads and utility services and those types of things that you have to supply further out, making it much more difficult and much more expensive for community members to pay for. So hopefully in the long term, you know, we understand the development's going to be there. And again, as I said, not opposed to it. It's much more that it's done in a systematic way, and that it keeps, I think the other thing that we should probably think about is that a lot of the reason that people want to move here is because of the beauty of the valley. There's nothing better than driving through Stallman Farms in the fall and seeing the colors changing on the trees, or the chili fields in the fall, or the springtime when things are just coming out of the ground. The first green out there typically is an alfalfa field or oat or silage field. So all those things play a big part in what makes the area attractive to people. And so I don't think that we want to lose that either.
So there's a lot of development happening in the state. John D'Antonio, the state engineer, said that New Mexico would see an 85% growth in population in the next 40 years. That growth will need water and land. Many people move to the cities where there's work. However, there's also another type of real estate in New Mexico. Anthropologist Sylvia Rodriguez used the term amenities migration. There are a lot of second homes and retirees who move to the land, which seems so beautiful with such a rich culture of the Spanish West. Many people build houses in remote areas using the term ranch without it being an actual working ranch. In doing research for this program, I spoke with several county extension agents who said that one trend that they had seen was an increase in ranchettes. These are large acreages that have been cut into 10 to 40 acre pieces of land. The lands are sold in high-class cowboy-style magazines like Cowboys and Indians. Ranches no longer work the same way when they become ranchettes. Rather than having a wide-open area where wildlife and ranch animals roam, people dig more wells, take more water, carve the land up with roads and underground power lines, which erode the arid climate. Chuck Kuchta manages a 1,600-acre ranch north of Taos, New Mexico. He uses an alternative type of ranching, managing the land the way that non-domesticated animals instinctively managed the land before the Europeans came. He explains how the land needs animals.
Well, like in a predator-prey situation, when you have a lion or something going after a herd of animals, they bunch up and poop and pee, and they stir up the ground. They knock things, they knock the grass over, they knock plant material over, organic matter on the ground, creates mulch, disturbs the soil. It's kind of like tilling it, a natural way of tilling it. And that's what they were put here for. Okay. Well, about the buffalo, back in the 1800s and before, when the buffalo roamed the land, there was a lot of them and there wasn't any fences. They had instinctive herd management. They never went back to the same place. They're nomadic animals, and they took different paths to different areas each year. It might be 10 miles from a grazing spot one year from the next. They never went back to the same place to eat. Maybe 3, 2, 6, 10 years, depending where it was and how many animals were around.
This is Roger Bowe, a cow-calf rancher from around San Juan in the eastern part of the state. The Bowes have been on their ranch since they homesteaded in 1907. Mr. Bowe explains that part of the problem is suburban creep, like the ranchettes, but it's not only ranchettes coming in. It's also the shift in land prices around the nation, bringing other ranching operations in, pushing New Mexico land prices way up.
The first thing is that I've always said that you're either in the beef business or you're in the land business. And you can't be in both. Right now, land is costing anywhere from around $300 an acre. And it takes 40 acres to a cow. So that's, what, $12,000 for a cow unit. If you put it out at 10% interest, there's $1,200. Well, the calf will only bring a maximum of $600 to $700 if you do a really good job. And so there's no way to make it by buying the land. It's not based on its productive capacity. It's based on speculation. What's happened is a lot of guys from areas that are being suburbanized, is what I call it, from rural to suburban, are selling their ranches and their property, and they're trading it. And there's a tax loophole. They'll trade that land and come down here or some other places where they can buy property, and they don't mind spending a lot of money for the property. It's made guys like me who's trying to make a living off the land, it's making it very, very tough. I'd be a lot better off selling out and just putting it in the bank at interest. And I don't see any trends that suggest it won't continue. And it's going to make the small guy like me. What's sad is my son, who's in the Army right now, wants to come back, but there's no way that him and I could make a living right now. And there's no way that he could buy in. It's too expensive. You'd have to save a lot of money. And to pass it on to the next generation, I have a lot of worries about. I just don't see how we can do it right now.
And who are the people coming in?
It's from all over. From Montana, Wyoming, other parts of the state even.
But is it there? Do they have operations, like large cattle operations?
Yes.
Okay, is it the dairy farms? Or?
It's not necessarily that dairy farms are buying the farmland south of here around Clovis and Portales, and that's not what's doing it. It's suburban creep. That's what I think. Well, if they can sell their land in Wyoming, Montana to the movie stars for $2,000 an acre, they can come down here and it's $300, seems cheap. You know, just probably 10 years ago is bringing 100. You can see ranchettes out here bringing, there was a place at Tubencary that divided a little, call them ranchettes, sold them 40 acres for I don't know how much money, $1,000 an acre, and there's no water, no electricity, people buying them sight unseen. So there's demand for ranches out in the middle of nowhere. They don't really know what they're getting, but and like I say, it's getting harder and harder to make it off the land, productive wise. If you haven't got it paid for, it's impossible.
You're listening to The Shift of Land, where we explore the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico. Individuals and groups around the state are trying to protect land. With the development are a whole range of issues that come in, like what's happened in Santa Fe, where once more and more development and affluency began to come in, it pushed up the tax base so that people whose families had lived on their land for centuries could no longer afford their taxes. They had to sell their houses and land and move to other areas. The same thing is happening in areas around Taos. This is Ernie Atencio, Executive Director of Taos Land Trust.
Taos Land Trust is one of about 1,600 land trusts across the country. And primarily what we do is help people permanently protect land from development. And it's an approach that's been used for over 100 years. Back in the 70s, it got much busier because at that time, Congress passed some new laws and IRS made some new rules that allowed people to take tax deductions for retiring development rights on their land. And that's when land trusts like ours started going. Taos Land Trust has been around since 1988. And in this area, we feel like some of the most important land that we ought to be protecting is the irrigated farmland. And any productive agricultural land, for that matter, even range land for grass-fed beef or whatever else you have. And oftentimes, particularly the irrigated land, is the land that is disappearing the quickest. That's the most attractive. It's green, it's verdant, it's got shade trees, and that's where people want to build their homes. So that's what we're up against. It's a tiny percentage of the land mass in Taos County, but it's being developed more quickly than anything else. We work with landowners to permanently retire development rights. It's completely voluntary. They retire only what they want to. They can continue working the land, farming it, grazing it. If they've got timber, they can continue sustainable timber harvest. But whatever they choose to retire, they do so in a conservation easement that's a permanent restriction on the property, no matter who owns it in the future. One thing that happens, one of the tax benefits from placing a conservation easement on your land, is that it reduces estate taxes or inheritance taxes when the elders pass on. And oftentimes, a decent-sized piece of land, the estate tax is going to be 45% of the value of that property. And around here, with property values that are over $100,000, $140,000 in some places, an acre, local families who don't have a lot of cash or income are not going to be able to pay that kind of estate tax bill. So what happens? They end up selling the land or selling half the land just to pay the estate tax bill. So that's part of the problem. You know, there's a whole sort of cultural philosophy, I think, or an ethos about our connection to the land. And like I said, it's sort of reciprocal, it's mutual. A lot of the landscape we see today that people really prize in northern New Mexico, and they want to protect this, you know, the land of enchantment, it's a cultural landscape. It's the product of generations, centuries, over a millennia of people living on the land and using it in certain ways. That's part of the connection, and I think particularly if you have some livelihood these days, and most of us who are native to northern New Mexico and have roots here are just a generation or two at most removed from a land-based existence, from farming or ranching. If you're connected to the land in that way, by working the land, I think it just creates, it strengthens that sense of connection to the land. A rancher I know said something like, the more you work the land, the more your heart is in the land. And I think that expresses it pretty eloquently. It's obvious when you look at a people who've lived in a place for a long time and you talk to them about the land, and it's obvious to see that connection to it. It's a connection in spirit. It's a connection, I think, in knowledge and wisdom. We were talking a little earlier about this idea of northern New Mexico and other rural parts of the state being places that still have a lot of resilience, that is, the ability to respond to big global economic changes, and as the oil economy becomes crippled and maybe eventually collapses, we still have a lot of wisdom here because people are still connected to the land. They know how to work it. They know the rhythms of the land. They know how to channel water out of the watershed very gently across the landscape, throw acequias into their fields. They know where and when to graze the livestock so they can maximize that. And these are skills that we're going to be needing more and more as the years go by. And we have that. And it's partly because, very much because, people are still rooted to the land. They're still connected to it. And land and culture are just, you know, glove in hand. They are one and the same. We talk a lot about a land-based culture. I mean, that's what people call it, a land-based culture. I always ask, well, what happens to the culture if we remove land from the equation, which is what's slowly happening here. But at this point, we still have a lot of that intact, which most places in the modern industrialized world can't really say that, but in northern New Mexico, it's true.
Peter Vigil from the Taos Soil and Water Conservancy District had explained that growth around the country is expanding faster than anyone can keep up with.
I don't think that we have, in any of our agencies, whether it's planning or regulation or review, the adequate funding and staff to really get a hold on the amount of development that's being proposed and completed. We've just grown too fast and too big too quickly. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing now is everybody's sort of becoming aware of that fact, and there's awareness being created, which is a positive aspect for myself, because that's always the first thing that needs to come about in order to change and to adapt. And so this awareness is because, you know, we do want to have a healthy environment and a sustainable environment. And we do want to have prosperity. And that balance is tough when you have just an onslaught of applications for subdivisions, and then you only have two staff people to look at those applications. And then from our point of view, I'm the only one in this office that does subdivision reviews. And, you know, when one comes to me, I put about 16 straight hours into that type of review. We use the latest technology. We aerial photos, soil maps, past drainage patterns. We go out and do a field review. And you know, all this type of 16 hours for every subdivision, I mean, there's not enough time in the day to do all the subdivisions. Mm-hmm. So at least by creating this kind of awareness and getting people to talk, whether they be developers or they do neighborhood associations or people that are just concerned mm-hmm. about natural landscape processes, getting them to talk together, okay, is the first step to come up with new and innovative ways to minimize the impacts of development. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way you can do that. And that comes about through people educating themselves and becoming aware of the situation. Mm-hmm. There are places all across this country that are doing new and innovative development strategies. And Taos is one of those places. I mean, we have a very sustainable-oriented population, and we have a lot of green thinking, and we have a lot of recycling-minded people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really neat, and it's sort of exciting and historic because all over the world, in fact, people are sort of waking up from their slumber, and they're realizing that this is a Mother Earth, and we need to do things in a different way. We can't just be a consumptive part of the problem or mass, as you say. So we find neat ideas. And the only thing is that we got to get the powers that be to adapt their regulatory processes to embrace those sustainable technologies. And it's happened in other parts of the country. There's sort of a science that's coming out of all of this that's called sustainable development. Mm-hmm. And what it's doing is it's creating more open space and less curb and gutter and less dependence on utilities and how you orient your house so that it's heated by the sun so you don't use that much electricity and the materials that's built in your house and how you can have water conservation methods. And, you know, so a good picture to imagine in your mind would be, you know, a subdivision around a farm. And in the middle of that subdivision is a working farm where people go and get community-based agriculture and they have a good backyard view of a beautiful farm rather than somebody else's lot. And that's what you're thinking of in designing these sustainable subdivisions. Now, they haven't come to our area yet. I mean, you know, we're at the tip of the iceberg on that. But there is strategies and proven subdivisions that even have what I would say businesses and stores in them that have this open space mentality, but smaller frontages, less driveway, less use of space for the sake of development. And it's really encouraging to see some of that. And hopefully we can incorporate that with the governing entities and the regulations so that a developer, if he wants to do that, isn't penalized because he's not following quote-unquote regulations.
Right. Mr. Vigil had explained that these new ideas will come very slowly, but there are possibilities to limiting development and maintaining a balance with the land so that we're able to maintain those open spaces. For this project, I went to the Tezuque Pueblo to talk to people involved with the Tezuque Agricultural Project, which works to make the pueblo self-sufficient and healthy. I asked the group of four men how development has affected the pueblo. This is Gailey Morgan.
You can see for yourself, you can go up and see all the houses that are going to multi-million dollar houses, you know. So who knows what they got going up there and what's going into the water. So we got to stay on top of that with our environmental department here. So that's one thing that we tell them to look in and make sure, you know, no illegal activities going on up there that where they're taking the water.
Emigdio Bayon from the Tezuque Agricultural Project explains how they use the land in a more traditional way.
You know, he mentioned about how they can affect, well, now we are okay. But actually, all these situations we try to prevent. When we're talking about sustainability, we try to prevent in the way how we can use more efficiently the water, the land, everything. Because we're expecting with the next field what we have, feeding whole the pueblo and all the needs. Okay, right now, for example, last year we increased our seed bank. That's another good thing. We increased our seed bank because the genetic engineering seeds. We increased our seed bank. We have very close to 45 or 50 different type of the beans. Beans you cannot find in some seed companies. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're planting peas here. We're planting medicinal herbs. We have our medicine grow over here and processing over here and making over here. You know, all these kind of the things. It's slow, the way he was telling you before Gaelis was mentioned. We try to go slow, but we try to do all what we need.
Land and culture are tied. Another issue that land transfers bring up is that if no one grows food on a small scale, we will be solely reliant on the agro-industry to supply our supermarkets. Without local farms, we have no trade, no local feasts. We will be dependent on unripened foods shipped over oceans, on highways and train lines. If we continue to rely on this type of food, then in regards to culture, maybe we should have grocery store fiestas and produce aisle dances. We could use the empty cereal boxes as instruments, along with TV dinner tin trays and tin cans, for our modern cultural expression. I asked Dr. Robert Jessen, professor of political science at the College of Santa Fe, what it means to be New Mexican.
Are you New Mexican?
I'm not a New Mexican. I'm a mix. My father's father, my grandfather, was from Denmark. My father grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He met my mom in Grenoble, France. My mother was in France because they fled after the Guerra Civil in Spain. So my mother is 100% Spanish, but my aunt and uncle live in France, and then I have this other side. So I'm a completely marginal person in terms of coming from one place or another place. And maybe it's because of that, but I really like places that have people who've been there forever. It's a way of knowing that I don't understand. I like people who've been in one place. I like accents where you find people who've been in one place so they know the place. So in terms of what is a New Mexican, my favorite way to deal with that in students, because I always ask people, where are you from? And they say, well, I was born and raised in New Mexico. Where are your parents from? And they say, well, they're from New York or Houston. So then it calls into question whether you are, even though you're born and raised here. And so there's this joke in Maine, because in Maine is a state where, and I lived in Maine for 3 or 4 years, and in Maine they have a joke where this Mainer is talking to a flatlander, and a flatlander is someone from Massachusetts, you see. And so the flatlander says, yeah, I'm a Mainer. And the Mainer says, nope, I'm sorry, but you ain't no Mainer. And the flatlander says, well, yeah, I can't be a Mainer, I've been here 17 years. I'm sorry, ain't born and raised here, can't be a Mainer. Well, they're my kids, they must be Mainers, they're born and raised here. Nope, I'm sorry, they ain't Mainers neither. Well, why not? Yeah. Your cat crawls in the oven and has kittens. You call them biscuits? And for all of the West, New Mexico, northern New Mexico, this area comes closest, even surpasses. New England is a place where people have been there for a long time. And it's a little bit skewed because I'm talking about Europeans who have been in this continent in a place for a long time. Because the Hispanos have been here for 400 years. But then you have the Pueblo, the Navajo, who have been here, and they share all this side by side. So for me, culture has to be generational. If you decide that you want to be a culture all of a sudden, well, you can practice that and you can sort of do it, but it really isn't embedded in you.
So where are you from? This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rappet for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, the Nado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder Associate Producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.